Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Nicholas Gordon, host of the Asian Review of Books podcast, done in collaboration with the New Books Network. In this podcast, we interview fiction and nonfiction authors working in, around, and about the Asia-Pacific region. Most of our understanding of the Mongol Empire begins and ends with Chinggis Khan and his sweep across Asia. His name is now included among conquerors whose efforts burn bright and burn out quick, Alexander the Great, Napoleon, and so on. Except the story doesn't end with Chinggis' death. As Professor Marie Favreau notes in The Horde, How the Mongols Changed the World, published by Harvard University Press earlier this year, the empire that Chinggis built continued to shape, incubate, and grow the political cultures it conquered. Even as the empire formally splintered, the ties that bound together the Mongols played a critical role in the growth of new identities and cultures. Marie Favreau is Associate Professor of History at Paris-Nanterre University. She has been a member of the French Institute of Oriental Archaeology in Cairo, a visiting scholar at the Institute for Advanced Study, and a research associate at the University of Oxford for the major project Nomadic Empires. Her books include The Golden Horde and the Mamluk Sultanate, published in French, and the graphic novel Genghis Khan. Today, Marie and I will talk about the empire the Mongols built, how it grew, what it covered, and how it changed. We'll talk about how the Mongols changed those they ruled and those they bordered against, and the geopolitical system they built. So, Marie, thank you so much for joining me on the show. Your book starts mostly with the death of Chinggis Khan and kind of what happens after he passes on and hands over to the next generation. So I guess to kind of introduce the interview, what happens after the death of Chinggis Khan? How does the Mongol Empire change? And what does the rest of the world look like at this time?
So thank you, first of all, for having me. Very happy to be here and to, having this conversation and, presenting my research on the Mongol Empire. So as you said in your introduction, this story starts after the death of Genghis Khan. Actually, the idea that we have of the Mongol Empire, so covering almost all of Eurasia, is really a vision of the empire at the end of the 13th century. So 2-3 generations after the death of Genghis Khan. So he died in 1227. And when he died, the Mongols had conquered mainly northern China. They had conquered the Tibetan, part of Tibet, but mainly the Tangut Kingdom. They had conquered great part of Central Asia. And they wanted to have more conquests, especially to the west and to the north. So they wanted to include the Russian principalities. But this was a project. And so Genghis Khan died. The empire was, divided between his four of his sons. And in my book, I really focus on the eldest son, named Jochi, who was in charge of the north and the west of the empire, and his successor, so his own son, great son of Genghis Khan, Batu, was put in charge of the conquest of the what is Russia today, mainly, and he would go up to the Eastern Europe. So in fact, it's interesting to concentrate on that period, so the second half of the 13th century, when we work on the Mongol Empire, because it's where the Mongol really shaped the Eurasian, a great part of the Eurasian landmass, in fact. And so Genghis Khan, in a way, launched a process, but it's just a process. And then there are huge developments after his death. So I thought that in my work, that it would be interesting to know more about the west and the north of the empire, because we have already a very very good publication on China and on the south and the east of the empire. So that was that was new in that sense. And if we think about in geopolitical terms of the world after the death of Genghis Khan, we have to understand that there are what we know today of China, Iran, and Russia were fragmentary powers. So in China, we had three powers mainly. So northern China, southern China, so the Song in the south, Qin in the north, and more in the center and in the west. We had the Tangut, and in Central Asia, we had the Karahitai Empire, the Khwarezmian Empire, and then the Abbasid and Ayyubid powers who were, you know, at the in Western Asia, and in the north, so the Russian principalities. So all these were the important powers that, you know, the Mongol, you know, met with and conquered and you know, in the 13th century. So
one thing your book does is, I think, or one of the main messages of your book is that the kind of image we have of the Mongols as some, let's say, a rampaging horde out for plunder is incorrect. Actually, this was a very, that their motivations for expansion were much more complex than I think the common image of them often portrays them as. I wonder if you can kind of get into a little bit kind of what motivated Mongol expansion.
Yes, absolutely. So, and this is really connected to what I've said just before. The thing is, because the empire would change, and it's a very long process of a century, each time the Mongol gain a new territory, a new power, a new integrated new subjected peoples, they would renegotiate their power with the outside world. So they would renegotiate with their neighbors. So it's clear that during the time of Genghis Khan, we cannot really see in the sources the idea of conquering the world. No, it's really about the neighboring world of the Mongols, of the Mongol steppe, which is, let's say, that is Mongolia today. If you want, you know, to have a map in your mind and think about Mongolia today. So it's all around. And then it would grow and grow and grow. And each time they have a new neighbor, they would renegotiate. So first, the idea is not to be, for the Mongol, the idea is not to conquer. You know, they are not interested into invading new territories, but what they want is to negotiate the trade relationship they have with their neighbors. So it starts often with trade issues. So the Mongol want to trade differently, and they have, in a way, we can put it that way, aggressive way of trading, and this will launch most of the time new conquests. That's one thing. So that's one big motivation. The other important motivation is really a relationship between among nomads. So it's nomad war very often. It's not against sedentary people, against sedentary communities. Not that the Mongol wants more cities and, you know, sedentary wealth, but they want to submit all the nomad communities of Eurasia. That's very clearly, that's their world, that's what they want, that's their, you know, goal. And because other nomad people refused, rejected, or, you know, were enemies of Genghis Khan and his successors, this would trigger more conquest, because those nomad would go as far as Western Asia and Central Europe, as far as Hungary, and the Mongol behind them would, you know, go after them and then conquer more and more people. So the motivation, there are a set of motivation, a series of motivation. And we cannot say that there's just one big reason at the beginning, that one big ideology that they want to conquer, you know, the world. No, this is really something that is built up, you know, generation after generation, year after year. And I really wanted to show that in the book.
Yeah, I was going to say the Mongols really seem to have it in for the Kipchaks at the beginning of the book. They seem to chase them all the way to Eastern Europe, as you say.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the Kipchak were among their worst, you know, biggest enemies, and they went after them, and they didn't submit immediately, and it took time. And then the Mongol were really after them, and not after the Russian, for instance, or not after the Hungarian king. But because some of the Russian princes and the Hungarian king allied with the Kipchak, but then the Mongol decided to attack them as well. So it's interesting to see how it's like a, I don't know if I can say that, well, like a snowball, you know, thing, and how it developed. So we really have to see it as a long process.
I want to cycle back to something you said earlier, which was about trade, how renegotiating or maybe aggressively negotiating trade relations was part of the motivation for expansion. And so I just want to kind of ask, what was the kind of trade structure that the Mongols tried to build within their empire? And I guess, in short, how did they benefit from it?
Well, what we know, what we see is very early on, under Genghis Khan already, the Mongol wanted to develop their trade network. So they wanted to trade with faraway people. And they wanted to trade, so for, you know, silk, but textiles, but not only, also for metal and for, you know, manufactured objects, ceramics, anything. And it's clearly very early on a crucial thing for the Mongol. I really wanted to explain that in my book, the fact that this is a good question, you know, why this is so crucial for the Mongols or for this specific nomadic societies. It's not only about, you know, gaining more wealth and, you know, gaining more luxury items, but it's also because they need to circulate and redistribute things, objects, because this is how they created their social glue, their social link. So they have to share and to redistribute and circulate things. And it's not about, gaining more and more, like capitalizing. It's really about redistribution. So they want to have a more stuff to redistribute. And in fact, they very early on too, they decided to use coins and coinage. So they produced their own coinage. First, they used Islamic coinage and Chinese coinage, but then they also produced their own, and they mixed, you know, existing coins, and they used paper bills, and also in the East, they tried to issued also paper coinage, let's say, in the South, in Iran. It didn't work. But then they worked a lot on how to the tools of exchange, you know. So they were interested in trading, but also in how to trade more and more easily. And they were also produced also a lot of trade contracts. They also valued a lot merchants and traders, and they created new statues for traders, even foreign traders. So the most perhaps famous foreign trader that were integrated into the Mongol Empire was perhaps Marco Polo. And there were, you know, several Italian traders that we know by name that were hired really by the Mongol rulers to trade for them. And so this is really a key aspect of their power. They see it as a key aspect of their power. And you can, in my book, I really wanted to show also how this developed, how they changed the rules, how they try to secure some routes, control them as well. So it's not something that Genghis Khan built in the early 13th century and then it's done. It's really something that you see in development. And they want more and more trade partners. So they want to reach well beyond their own frontiers. So they will reach up to Western Europe, up to Northern Europe. And I work also on that, you know, their connection with, you know, Scandinavian communities and even England, how they were all integrated actually in their huge trade network. So in that sense, they are extremely, really fascinating power. It's really, it's kind of unusual, the scale of the networks they developed.
So what was it like to be a vassal king to the Mongols. It seems like, especially I think in your discussion about Russia, the Mongols come in and a lot of the power structures in Russia seem perfectly capable of operating under the Mongols. But if you were a vassal and you signed these agreements or you agreed these relations with the Mongols, what were your obligations and how much autonomy did you have?
Well, yeah, that's a very important point. So first of all, it depends. It depends if you had submitted of your own free will or not. So there are a lot of statutes. So there are a lot of different statutes within the Mongol Empire. And I will come to the Russian. But before, if you think about the Uyghur ruler who submitted really on his own free will and very voluntarily, he had and his lineage and his own family had a very good position within the Mongol Empire. So if you would, join freely, willingly, then you would have a very good and strong position. Sedentary and, also people were really seen as on the border, like the Russian princes. There were very early on sort of agreement between them and the Mongols. So the idea was to visit the ruler, Mongol ruler, so the Khan court, rather often, and to stay at the Khan's court sometimes a year or several months to really meet face to face with the Mongol ruler and his family. So the Mongols want to be close to their vassals. They want to know them. And often they also wanted their vassals to marry Mongolian princesses. So it was really seen as a privilege to marry a Mongolian princess. And it was not, offered to anyone. So it was really a big privilege. And after that, so that would seal the agreement in a way. And the last important thing is the use of we call it the hostage institution. But the idea was to you would leave as a vassal your own son or nephew, or let's say your, how can I put that? Like your intended successor. At the Mongol court, he would remain there with the Mongol, ruler's family and companions, and he would be trained at the Mongol court. He would be trained and would be also, he would learn also the language probably, and he would become a loyal vassal in turn, but also it would make the vassals loyal because they have their sons at court, and that's why we call it also the hostage institution in a way. But we have to see, so of course it's a domination tool from the Mongols, but it's also the way they envision governing, and they want to be, it's an empire, so it's very, multiple communities, we're in multiple religions and cultures and languages, but at the same time they want them to come to the Mongol camp, main camp, and to know the Mongols. So that's something I think that is rather, interesting to see. And it worked well in many cases.
So to move on to a different topic, what were the Mongol centers of power like? They obviously don't live in established sedentary cities like other empires had as the centers of power. The book talks about these tent cities. I guess, what were these tent cities like?
Yeah, so that's exactly the way I try explain it also to my students, those tent cities. So I call them also hordes. That's why I kept the title for my book, because it's a key word. So it's an old word, orda, or do we have it in different, under different pronunciation in the sources? It's a term that was used before the Mongols by other nomadic powers, and it would it was a camp, a military camp. But not only, it was also the rulers, women, households. It would include the craftsmen. It would include the traders. It would include all the people who followed the ruler or the you know, ruling family members during their nomadic migration. And so this moving city, so I call it like mobile city or moving city, was, so there were several in the Mongol Empire, and I really worked on how many they were in the west of the Mongol Empire, and where they were, and where they moved, and how they moved. But all those tent cities or mobile cities or hordes were really the centers of you know, of power, of administration, of government. And even if the Mongols always also favored building of buildings of cities, settlements, villages, so they don't really want to destroy sedentary life at all. They also financed, sponsored building constructions of, you know, religious monuments, of cities. But power was concentrated in, hordes and, you know, mobile cities, so camps. And that made, their way of ruling was so different from other empires, because they have this mobility and says, you know, it's very seasonal way of moving, and they move along rivers. And I really wanted to explain that in my book for people to understand that because it's not because they don't have major capital city like Rome, it doesn't mean that it's not a very advanced, organized power, and it doesn't mean that it's not an empire. An empire doesn't need a capital city like Rome. You can, you know, create a big, huge, powerful empire like the Mongols with cities, but, you know, with also mobile centers of power, which is what they did. And then another important part of my research is also to understand how they communicate and connect in between, you know, these mobile centers, because it's interesting to see how they, you know, were able to build up like itinerary, sent envoys, how fast the envoys could go from a horde to another, so from, you know, a river to another, how they crossed rivers and how they traveled and all that. So that's also, really part of their domination tools. And I think that's, it's not totally specific to the Mongols, because they were nomadic powers before them, but the scale of the Mongol Empire make it so, you know, impressive and in a way different.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So one of the, let's call them historical turning points, I think, in the book, at least from my reading of it, was when the Khans converted to Islam. And obviously, they were still attacking Islamic culture, so it didn't, you know, lead to huge change in their behavior. But I guess kind of how important is the conversion to Islam by the Khans in kind of understanding the development of the Mongol Empire?
Well, yeah, that's also a crucial issue. And it's specifically important when you work on the western part of the Mongol Empire, because it's where the Mongols converted first. So there are two ways to enter. So first, for Islam. Well, let's say that the Mongol destroyed the main Islamic centers in Central Asia and even in Western Asia in the first half of the 13th century. So they forced the Abbasid to fly away. They went to Cairo. They destroyed the Ayyubid power, so the Khwarezmian power as well. And they were kind of, you know, a vacuum of power in the Islamic world. The ruler of the western part of the Mongol Empire, called Berke, clearly converted to Islam in the mid 13th century because it was probably politically clever to do that because of the vacuum of power. So he could suddenly become, you know, the new leader. There's no more real caliph. There are no more, you know, Ayyubid rulers. There are no more sultan. In fact, they were, especially in India, but he wanted to claim, you know, some of the, the Muslim leadership, let's say. And he allied with a new power that just took shape in Egypt and, you know, a little bit in Syria, that we know today under the name of the Mamluk Sultanate. And the Mamluk needed slave warriors for their armies. And these slave warriors came, most of them, from the Eurasian steppe, especially the Black Sea steppe area and the Northern Caucasus. All these areas were under the control of the Mongols at that time. So this Mongol ruler, Berke, made an agreement actually with the Mamluk Sultan and authorized the slave trade. And this is a key thing because it will change the balance of power in the Islamic world on the long run, because the Mamluk would become at the end of the 13th century one of the major Islamic powers of the world, and this is really because of this connection with the Mongols. So that's one important thing. So the Mongols are not simply the one who destroyed Baghdad and killed the caliph. They are also the one who promoted the Mamluk system. So that's something I really want to, underline now, and I did in my book. The second aspect that we have to consider is it's not because some of the Mongol rulers, especially in the north of Eurasia, are converted to Islam, that the Mongol turned totally to Islam and just, you know, fight the other religions. The Mongol had this developed a set of rules, set of policies that we call, because it's a bit convenient, the Mongol toleration or Mongol tolerance. But actually, the idea was to accept different religions as long as the religious leaders supported the Mongols. So because the Christian, we mentioned the Russian, but we could think about, also the Armenians and also the Jewish communities in Crimea supported the Mongol ruler, then they were accepted and they were even protected by the Mongols. So they converted to Islam, but at the same time they maintained this system of a religious toleration that, you know, which included, you know, other religions, mainly Christians, Jewish religions, and Buddhist Taoists. This is more for the East. And to finish on this, it's not only that they let them practice their religion. It goes really deeper into, you know, local and social life, in a sense that the Mongols exempted from taxes and from conscription the religious leaders of these communities. So it means that if we think just about the Russian Orthodox, that they would gain a lot of, you know, money in a way from this tax exemption, thanks to this, you know, Mongol toleration policy. And they would build more, you know, churches and schools, and they would benefit from this, from the whole system. And probably we have the same, you know, we can see the same in, you know, other areas, especially in the East, but that, you know, I concentrate on the West, and it's clear that, you know, the Christians were really welcome and had very strong position in the hordes or in the Western part of the Mongol Empire, even though the rulers were Muslims. So, yeah, that's something to consider, absolutely.
So I think I have one more question about the Mongol Empire and how it related to the people it ruled over before kind of maybe moving on to its the Mongol Empire's relevance to the present day. But again, my last question about the Mongol Empire and its relations to the people it conquered was the Mongol Empire, I think, plays a very large role, at least in, let's call it the official tellings of Russian history. The Mongols play a key role, I think, in the official narrative of the creation of Russia. But when looking at kind of the actual history, how are the Mongols key to the creation of Russia and of Russian political identity?
Well, yeah, that's a very complicated issue and interesting at the same time. And in my book, I really, although the book is not about the Russian, but and really about the Mongol, I really wanted to show how their relationship was, you know, how you know, formative it was for the Russian, you know, power and society. And so let's say, first of all, that we think about Russia today or the Russians, so, but in the early 13th century, they were fragmentary power, fragmentary societies. The what we call the Russian were principalities, and they did not have like one single strong identity. Of course, the Mongol forced them to be together, because for the Mongols it was much easier to dominate one single, you know, organized power than, you know, petty fragmentary communities and, you know, were at war all the time. So they really wanted the Russian to be one group, you know, if I can put it that way. And also they asked them to pay tributes, to pay taxes, but one tribute. So they forced all these people to pay one big, you know, tribute, and they forced them to be in relationship with each other, with one another. So so that's part of the process of, you know, unification of, you know, the Russian, that, you know, transformed the Russia, the Russians. And the other important and interesting thing is how they interfered with the system of princely succession. So in this Russian lands, you had one grand prince who, you know, was, you know, on top of the other princes. And the Mongols, not at the very beginning, but after, you know, after some time, decided really to, it's not that they decided, but they really wanted to identify one family, one dynastic lineage, because it was easier for them too to have, you know, one clear vassal. So after, rather quickly, actually, they start to support the Moscow, the Muscovite line, but that was not. That was not the case at the beginning. So it was not something they decided, but it's just something that is clear at some point. The source is very clear in the 14th century that the Mongol really supported Moscow. And this, of course, will have huge consequences. So I wanted to show that in the book. And so it's a complicated legacy, actually, because the Russian had to you know, fight the Mongols, but also the gain from them. And it's important, I think, and it's fair to show the whole, the complexity of the thing. The other important point is the fact that clearly in the beginning of the 13th century, these Russian principalities were on the periphery of Eurasia. They were not leaders in terms of trade. They were not really integrated into, they were a little bit integrated into the Islamic, trade network, but not really completely integrated. And with the Mongols, they became completely part of it. So because, you know, they were part of the empires, they gain a lot of, you know, the Mongol rules of exchange, the Mongol way of, you know, opening doors in between communities because they wanted people to trade their subjects, to be open, to let others pass through their lands. And, you know, so the Mongol really forced the Russian princes to open up doors. And then this also will certainly have an impact on the way, you know, Russia developed afterwards. So I'm not saying that there is this, you know, direct legacy or that, but still, this is a key moment for the, you know, development of the Russian principalities. And it's, and when I had to explain why, after certainly a harsh moment of conquest, we can see through sources and, you know, archaeology, construction of stone churches and, you know, development of craftsmanship and economic growth at the end of the 13th and the early 14th century in the Russian principalities. When I had to explain that, that's a work, the work of the historian, we need to understand that. So so the picture is, I wanted to show the complex picture of, you know, this relationship between Mongols and Russians.
So I have, again, one last question and kind of gestures a bit to the present day. The book talks about let's call it the Pax Mongolica, the idea that within the Mongol Empire, that created a structure that led to trade, the safety and security within the Mongol Empire helped encourage migration, trade, sharing of information. In a similar way that I think people talk about the Pax Romana, or to use a contemporary example, the Pax Americana, the idea that an empire, a hegemon, leads to security and safety, which then allows for trade and commerce and international exchange and everything. But it seems like as you continue through the history of the Mongol Empire, rather than offer security, the Mongols' superior status seems to instead be a source of instability. So I guess to kind of end the interview, what lessons do you think the Mongol Empire poses for contemporary history today?
Well, yeah, that's a very interesting question. So actually, if I can start to answer the first aspect of your question about the Pax Mongolica. So in the book, I really moved to what I call the Mongol exchange. I developed this notion, analyzed it, and I thought, okay, Pax Mongolica, what doesn't work with Pax Mongolica? First, what doesn't work is that it looks like close to Pax Romana, and this is a very different kind of empire and a different period. The other thing is that, you know, worried me was the word Pax. As you said, also you mentioned instabilities, and so it's not about peace at all. And in fact, when you look at this construction of the Mongol Empire, this long process of, you know, at the end, if you look at the western part of the Mongol Empire, it's 3 centuries. You see that it's not that you have a conquest period and then conquest end and then a peace with, you know, development of trade and, you know, new institution. From the very beginning, there are war of conquest, there's violence, and at the same time, there are new rules, new policies, there's trade, there's diplomacy. So it's all, it goes together. And so I like the idea, and I really wanted to do that in my book, to put together this, to connect more and better these two phenomenon of the one of the conquest and the violence and the one of, you know, that is more trade and exchange. So also there's another thing that explains why I choose this phrase of, you know, the Mongol exchange. It was not invented by me. That was used also by some of my colleagues. The thing is, the Mongol created clearly a new order in Eurasia, a new way of trading, new opportunities also for people, not only for traders, but also, you know, for missionaries, travelers, for religious leaders, for intellectuals and scholars, and scientists. So they created something new, okay, but at the same time, they did not control everything. It's something that is beyond them, clearly, that it's something that reached, you know, Western Europe, that reached, other parts of the world that were not directly under the power of the Mongols. And I think that what I like in the, this phrase of the Mongol exchange, it's like for the Colombian exchange, as we say, for, the so-called discovery of US, but that is of America, which was in fact, you know, a sudden moment of connection of faraway areas and the consequences of this new, you know, connections. And that's exactly what we see for the Mongol Empire. So I like also to use sometimes the term of globalization. Although, of course, it's not exactly like today, but still, this suddenly connection of faraway areas, suddenly new transfer of, you know, technologies, new trade opportunities, but also new disease, epidemic, and so it's a wider phenomenon, and I really wanted to show that in the book, that the Mongol are not in control of everything at all, and they were leaders. They produced certainly new wealth, new opportunities. They produced violence as well, but also they had to themselves adapt to, you know, bigger phenomenon. And of course, in the book, I also talk about the what we call the Black Death, but, you know, the plague, huge plague pandemic of the mid-14th century, and how the Mongol coped with it, and, you know, the consequences for their own system, the pressure on their own political system. And I think that in that sense, it's very interesting for us today. I mean, sounds, you know, familiar in certain ways, this moment of, you know, globalization with all its positive aspects and all its more, you know, complicated and even negative aspects as well. So I think that, there are here, you know, something that explains why there is so much interest in the Mongol Empire and the Mongol, Great Mongol Exchange. Now, today, again, because, it's interesting to see how human societies, you know, dealt with this global phenomenon in the past. And I would maybe to hand on that, the way the Mongol connected. You know, because today we have this vision of the world that is very much shaped by nation states. And we have to think about the world with internet. It's easier now to a world that that is without frontiers, or where frontiers are, you know, not the one of the nation states. And in the medieval period, during Mongol, you know, this big Mongol moment, it's not the nation state of today. The map is very different, so we have to have in mind a different map, to build up a different map, and that's why I think it's interesting to think about, you know, human history. So, for example, for a French like me, the Mongols are, you know, in a way part of my history, because I'm a citizen of the world, and that's it's interesting for me, you know, to know how, you know, what were the Mongol, what did the Mongol create, and how, you know, they managed, and how, what they made possible during this big globalization moment that we call the Mongol Exchange.
So with that, thank you for listening to our interview with Professor Marie Favreau, author of The Horde, How the Mongols Changed the World. Marie, I have one actual last question for you. Where can people find your work and what's next for you?
Well, they can find my book, The Horde, just recently published, I think, in most libraries and in many bookshops. And they can order it online easily. And they can also find, of course, some of my articles for free on my website, academic website. And also my next project, very much connected to what I just said about the Great Mongol Exchange, it's going to be a big exhibition on the Mongols. I wanted to show wider audience the objects that the Mongol created, produced, used, exchanged, circulated. And so it will be this big exhibition that will take place in France first and hopefully in other parts of the world in 2023, 2024.
So you can follow me, Nicholas Gordon, on Twitter at NickRIGordon. That's NickRIGordon. You can go to AsianReviewOfBooks.com to find other reviews, essays, interviews, and excerpts. Follow on Facebook or on Twitter at Book Reviews Asia. That's reviews plural. And you can find countless other author interviews at the New Books Network at NewBooksNetwork.com. We hope you subscribe and you're listening to the Asian Review Books podcast, now found on all your favorite podcast apps, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. Rate us, recommend us, and share us with your friends if you want to support us continuing to review those writing in, around, and about Asia. Next week, join us for an interview with Suchitra Vijayan, author of Midnight's Borders, A People's History of Modern India. But before then, Marie, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed this conversation.